Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Beter. Today is December 21, 1975, and this is my monthly audio letter number 7. As I celebrate Christmas with my family a few days from now, I will be thanking God for the precious gift He has given to all of us this year, the gift of time. Because, my friend, the year 1975, even as difficult and trying as it has been, was a year of reprieve due to delays in the timetable of the four Rockefeller brothers. At this very moment, some important parts of their plan are as much as 1 year behind schedule. And in the meantime, more and more Americans have been awakening to the truth of what is going on. Yes, we have been granted a little more time than we might have had to respond to the menace we all face. But we dare not relax and waste whatever time we have left. The four Rockefeller brothers are working feverishly to make up for lost time. Overseas, the way is being paved for war, including that nightmare the world has feared for 30 years, nuclear war. Here at home, our economic woes are getting worse, while a corrupt government controlled by the Rockefeller brothers tells us prosperity is just around the corner. Preparations for the dictatorial new Rockefeller Constitution keep marching on, and the man who has conspired for 20 years to become our first dictator, Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, stands poised at the threshold, ready to seize the presidency. That is why it is so important that more and more alert Americans are now asking just one question: what can I do? I'm convinced that now, at last, there are enough of us to launch a successful rescue of our great free republic. Therefore, I have just unveiled a strategy for action, which I truly believe can and will save our country. It is a strategy which you, as an individual, can undertake starting right where you are. It uses the powers you are granted by the most basic law of the land, our present United States Constitution. And if you will faithfully do your part, you can rest assured others all over America will be doing theirs too. The result, if we will each do our own part, is a plan of action which, in my opinion, cannot be stopped. This entire plan of action is presented in a new audio book, recorded December 15, 1975. And it's entitled, What We Can Do to Save America. And it is my answer to the question, what can I do? The challenge before us, my friend, is to regain control of the government that belongs to us. And we must act quickly before that control, which is already in the hands of the Rockefeller brothers, slips forever beyond our reach. Control, that is the word, more than any other that sums up the actions of the four Rockefeller brothers. Control is both the end toward which they work and the means by which they extend their reach still further. Control of money and of government. Control of industry and of big labor. Control of natural resources and of human resources. The incredible financial wealth of the Rockefellers is actually nothing more than a result of this insatiable drive for control. And it grows continuously due to their control over your money, your resources, your labor, and your government. They believe they have a right to do all these things. because they are convinced that they have been divinely ordained to rule the world. So, for example, using the CIA for their own private purposes is right and proper according to their concept of themselves as America's royal family. It matters not what you and I think. Only they know best. All of this and much more is made clear in the book that was written for them as their Mein Kampf in 1930, The American Rich by Hoffman Nickerson. Today, I want to discuss three topics that point out some of the fruits of such control by the Rockefeller brothers. Topic number one, how political control produces cover-ups and paralysis instead of truth and action. Topic number two, how economic control produces deepening artificial depression and monetary chaos instead of real prosperity. And topic number three, how the alliance between Rockefeller corporate socialism and Soviet state socialism is taking us into nuclear war. Topic number one, in their drive for control, the Rockefellers are trying to snare us all in their giant trap, catch us so that we cannot wrestle free or fight back. But they know that if they move too quickly, we may notice what they are up to and react to protect ourselves. So they have been moving with great patience and determination over a period of several decades to get their trap assembled and in place, ready to spring it on all of us. To understand what is really happening, therefore, you should do as they do. Look at long spans of time, compress them in your mind, and see where things are really headed. Gradualism is the tactic now being used, while TV, sports, and other distractions are being used to focus people's attention away from what is really happening. Thus, even while many people find the idea of a new Constitution for America preposterous, many of its provisions are already being put in place, ready for ratification by a national referendum in the near future. The federal government already regards the United States as divided up into 10 regions, the forerunners of the 10 so-called new states. The Federal Election Commission, along with some other activities, is the forerunner of the electoral branch, and so on. So keep your eye on their objective, that is, the direction in which they are moving events, so that you won't be fooled by their shifts in timing to meet their various contingency plans. The secret new Constitution, which was developed over a 10-year period to fit the outline laid down personally by Nelson Rockefeller himself, just as he did our present 25th Amendment, this secret new Constitution is coming sooner or later, unless we stop it once and for all. As former Senator Sam Irwin said so emphatically just a few days ago, and I quote, "We don't need a new Constitution. Ours has weathered many storms in the past 200 years. It was written to last for the ages," unquote. But, my friend, if we leave the Rockefeller machine in control of our government, our communications media, and our economy, we will have a dictatorial new Constitution. Senator Irwin is quoted as saying something else, too. And it is supremely ironic. Concerning Richard Nixon, he said, quote, "He had the most pronounced, aggravated notion about the powers of the presidency. He envisioned the president as being something of an absolute monarch," unquote. However well these words may have applied to Nixon, they apply far better to the man who made, used, and then unmade Nixon, that is, Nelson Rockefeller. Perhaps Senator Irwin himself now realizes how cleverly he was used in the Watergate coup d'etat, since he said last spring, and I quote, "If I had known then what I know now, I would never have voted to confirm Nelson Rockefeller," unquote. Whenever possible, the Rockefeller brothers maneuver people into doing what they want done without their puppets even being aware of it, not at least until later. But the Rockefeller style also includes more solid avenues of control over all sides, if possible, in every arena, including that of politics. Thus, for example, the Rockefellers have their hooks equally deep into both the Democratic and Republican parties, as well as fringe political fronts, both left and right. And while they have often found it advantageous to maintain a so-called liberal image with their public relations, they are not true liberals, any more than certain of their lackeys who wear the conservative label are true conservatives. As Nelson Rockefeller himself said in Dallas on September 12, 1975, and I quote, "Conservative and liberal to me are misleading as labels," unquote. These and other similar labels have completely lost any utility they may once have had thanks to their control by the Rockefeller brothers. Their only true loyalty is to themselves. And that transcends all of the conventional boundaries of political affiliation. A perfect example of Rockefeller control of all sides of a political situation is before us right now, in the alleged presidential campaign. I say alleged because there is no doubt at all as to the outcome under the Rockefeller scenario. Instead, the game is being played for other reasons. For the moment, the most prominent players on the stage are four: Humphrey, Reagan, Ford, and his ventriloquist Rockefeller. Hubert Humphrey wears a big label that reads Liberal Democrat, while the equally large label on Ronald Reagan reads Conservative Republican. President Ford's label is a large question mark. Nelson Rockefeller's label, which, by the way, is made of solid gold, is rather large. It reads, "Liberal New Deal Democrat turned instant conservative Republican," unquote. It looks like quite a field, doesn't it? But it so happens that Nelson Rockefeller has the other three in the palm of his hand, and his own label is only for show. Hubert Humphrey is currently the beneficiary of the so-called Humphrey phenomenon, an undeclared candidacy that is being made to look impressive by the Rockefeller major media and by polls which can easily be manipulated. Humphrey's well-concealed control of a huge major multinational oil company for over 20 years has been very helpful to his Rockefeller supporters behind the scenes. Partly for this reason, a possible multi-million dollar tax case against him by the Internal Revenue Service has been covered up under presidential seal, and the IRS FBI agents who worked on the case are no longer around. Ronald Reagan, of course, is the polished actor who has been rehearsing so-called conservative lines ever since 1950. That was the year when, during congressional hearings, he officially admitted his previously ultra-liberal activities, the claim that he had seen the light and was turning over a new leaf. Yet his actions, as sharply distinguished from his words, have never really changed. He has maintained many active ties with Rockefeller-dominated organizations, such as their complex of governmental control groups known collectively as 1313 in Chicago. The Reagan administration in California was heavily populated with people from the Rockefeller stables, and the Reagan record in California parallels that of Rockefeller in New York in many ways. But Reagan has consistently spoken as if his views and policies were totally opposite to those of Rockefeller. Reagan's service on Rockefeller's CIA cover-up commission earlier this year, therefore, helped to quiet the cover-up fears of some who are not aware of Reagan's strong Rockefeller ties. President Ford is where he is because the then President Nixon double-crossed his boss, Nelson Rockefeller. When Agnew was forced to resign, Nixon was supposed to nominate Rockefeller, but Nixon could see where that would lead. So instead, he selected Gerald Ford, whose political star had risen considerably after his participation in the work in defense of the Warren Commission. Good old Jerry was well known and well liked by his colleagues, yet his confirmation hearings bogged down unexpectedly. Behind the scenes, Nelson Rockefeller applied the brakes until Ford agreed to nominate him, Rockefeller, upon Nixon's departure from the presidency. Once the agreement was reached, Ford's confirmation hearings rapidly concluded favorably, and Nelson Rockefeller immediately resigned as governor of New York, surreptitiously moved into his Washington, D.C. residence, and personally finished watergating Nixon out of the White House. Nelson was so proud of his success in this project that he wrote to a banker friend in Mexico afterward to tell him all about it. Can you imagine? Thus, Rockefeller control denies us any real choice in national politics. Ultimately, the Rockefellers choose all the presidential candidates that count and have ever since Woodrow Wilson's time. We, the voters, are then given the useless privilege of choosing which of their hand-picked puppets we want, just like they do in Soviet Russia. Even in the election itself, the deck is stacked in favor of their preferred choice. But just in case, they control the other side, too. If this isn't taxation without representation, I don't know what it is. In Congress, too, most of our politicians end up in the Rockefeller pocket one way or another. Some deliberately throw in their lot with the Rockefellers and become active Rockefeller agents. Others become compromised by skeletons in their closets and are pawns in the Rockefeller game of blackmail and double cross here in Washington. And still others just go along to get along, not rocking the boat. And so when government abuses become so flagrant that they are detected, we are still left without recourse because the Rockefellers control the investigations in almost every case. As I speak to you, the ante has gone up due to the leakage of radioactive plutonium-239 superpoison from the bullion depository at Fort Knox, and the government is doing nothing whatsoever to stop it. My previous information was that the region which has been primarily affected by the leakage over the past several years consists of a swath through Kentucky, my home state of West Virginia, and Virginia, with a combined population of over 9 million people. But on November 8, 1975, a secret meeting was held in the White House to discuss alternative means of disposing of the deadly poison. The discussion included some ideas that would be as insane as the poison itself, such as dumping all 60 pounds of it into the underground streams that lie under Fort Knox. Not only might this allow the poison to spread uncontrollably from there, but it could possibly also cause contamination of any of the huge underground caverns under Fort Knox, which are used for natural gas storage. Now, if this were to happen, natural gas could carry traces of the radioactive plutonium poison straight into the industrial plants and homes of thousands of people in that area. The deadly plutonium radiation would be unaffected by passing through gas flames, after which it could be inhaled or set on to food. I received no further information concerning the action, if any, taken after the November 8 White House meeting. But I have received updated information to the effect that the poison is now spreading throughout the entire southeast of the United States and even beginning to enter the Gulf of Mexico. 36 million Americans are now at stake. And what is our government doing about it? Nothing. The White House meeting had only one purpose: to save face for the wrongdoers, not to save 36 million lives. And what about Congress and all those investigations we keep hearing about? Consider Senator Frank Church, who is our newest presidential candidate. On November 20, 1975, he explained the release of his committee's report about assassination plots on foreign leaders with the words, and I quote, "The people were entitled to know what went wrong and why," unquote. But when it comes to an immediate, deadly danger to all of us, caused by the same elements of the intelligence community, apparently Senator Church believes we are not entitled to know, since he has been covering up this vital information now for 4 months, while the situation grows steadily worse. And for over 2 months, the same has been true of his counterpart in the House, Congressman Otis Pike. Meanwhile, what else is happening in the executive branch, specifically the Treasury Department? My friend, I believe it is time to let you in on an example of the evasions, half-truths, and distortions which Rockefeller bureaucrats use to cover their tracks. I call it a lesson in bureaucratic gobbledygook, the slippery language that some people also call double talk. For over 3 months now, all of our attempts even to communicate directly with the government about the twin disasters at Fort Knox have met with nothing but a very loud silence. Having deepened and confirmed our own guilt time and again through various slips in the past, they apparently no longer have the courage or the courtesy even to answer us. Through an indirect channel, however, we were able to extract a letter from Mrs. Mary Brooks, the director of the Mint, dated November 21, 1975. This indirect channel is Congressman Kenneth Robinson of Virginia, who, while he does not choose to pursue the Fort Knox matter on his own, has at least cooperated with us in ways such as this. In this regard, he is exceptional. No one else in the entire United States Congress has done even this much. As I read the letter, try, if you can, to find any clear-cut yes or no type answer to anything. You will only find one, to the effect that a certain statement, and I quote, "is simply not true," unquote. But the statement referred to is not our statement, but a carefully selected misstatement of our charges by someone else. Now here's the letter. "Dear Mr. Robinson, thank you for your letter of November 10, 1975, concerning allegations that plutonium-239 was stored in the so-called Central Core Vault at the United States Bullion Depository, Fort Knox, Kentucky. We do not store plutonium-239 or any other radioactive substance at the depository and have no reason to believe that it is stored there by other government agencies. We authorized the military at Fort Knox to make radiation tests in the depository last week. We were informed that the tests did not disclose any evidence of radioactive material. The allegations relating to the so-called Central Core Vault are carried in a Swiss newsletter entitled Myers Finance and Energy that is currently being circulated by those who are persistent with all the wild allegations about the bullion depository at Fort Knox. The newsletter discusses Dr. Peter D. Beter's allegations and states," and the letter quotes as follows, "In 1942-43, Major Stanley Tatum, T-A-T-O-M, designed and oversaw the construction of a central core vault below the main vault. To get to this ultra-safe vault, an elevator had to be installed, and it used up the space occupied by 12 of the former vault compartments. This explains why the numbering in the vault compartments upstairs had a 12-digit gap, unquote. And Mrs. Brooks' letter continues, and I quote, "This statement is simply not true. There were no major alterations to the vault after construction of the depository was completed in 1936. The elevator was installed at the time the depository was constructed. We have no record of Major Stanley Tatum, T-A-T-O-M, designing or overseeing the construction of a central core vault. In fact, we do not, and find no record that we ever did, refer to any part of the depository by that name. The visitor's log at the depository does show the name of Major Daniel F. Tatum, T-A-T-U-M, as coined on the officer in charge, on July 29, 1942. We also have records which show that a steel door was erected by the Champion Wire and Iron Works, Louisville, Kentucky, at the entrance to the corridor that leads to compartments numbered 1 through 14 in the basement level of the depository. This work was completed on January 7, 1942, and the number 15 was assigned to the door. After this work was completed, gold was stored in the corridor for a time during which the door was locked and sealed. Still quoting from her letter, "The allegation that there is a 12-digit gap in the numbering of compartments is also inaccurate. Our records show that the depository had 28 compartments, 14 on the lower level and 14 on the upper level at the time of construction. The compartments on the lower level were numbered 1 through 14, and the corridor door was numbered 15 when it was added in 1942. The compartments on the upper level were numbered 21 through 34. There is no record of the numbers 16 through 20 ever being used on vault compartments of the depository. If I can be of further assistance in this matter, please let me know. Sincerely." And there follows the signature of Mary Brooks, Director of the Mint. My friend, letters like this one are the product of a year and a half of continuous effort on their part to refine their story and put their very best foot forward. They are written with great care, with careful choice of every word. The letter I have just read to you, in fact, was not even written by Mary Brooks alone. Much of it was written by an official in the General Accounting Office who has ties to the intelligence industry. The GAO itself is implicated in the Fort Knox cover-up through the falsified gold audit done in the fall of 1974. So this letter is important, and it deserves closer examination.